committee to order, and today we're going to have some overviews from some of the department. Bruce Horner, the director.
Not the bridges again. The bridges are falling. We're going to see that.
My boss here. I want to make sure. I don't, so where do we want me?
Right
there. Okay.
Well, you don't have one, though.
Excuse me. I feel like I'm in a hole. See if this one's any higher. Good morning, Mr. Chairman,
morning.
Members of the committee. Pleasure to be here. For the record, I'm Bruce Horner. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Transportation, and I've been here for just not quite 2 years now in this position. I think those of you who know me know that I worked for ODOT previously as the region manager up in the Portland area, so I am very familiar with the department and its issues. What I wanted to do this morning, which I think was what the chair wanted, was to give you a very brief overview of the Department of Transportation, essentially what we do, and how we do it. We've got presentations prepared for you over your next couple meetings from the operational areas of the department that talk about the specific things that we do in various areas of the department. You have a PowerPoint presentation, a copy of what we have up on the board before you, which I will walk through very quickly. I also will try to answer any questions you have, but I think I'm just trying to tee it up for my division administrators to come in and talk to you about their particular areas. At the end, I will also give you an overview of some of the opportunities and threats, frankly, that I see confronting the transportation system in the state of Oregon. So let me begin. I think it's important to note, if you look at, let's go to the PowerPoint presentation, and I think right up front, it's important for you to understand the Oregon Department of Transportation's mission, which is to provide a safe, efficient transportation system that supports economic opportunity and livable communities for Oregon. And if you turn to the second page of the chart, you'll see a very quick organizational overview of how the department is organized and some of the key staff managing various programs. What I wanted to let you know is we have an organization of not quite 4,700 individuals, men and women, who are really dedicated to the transportation safety, mobility, and livability and economic development of the state of Oregon. And in fact, we take it so seriously that we, again, always manage and measure our performance both for effectiveness and efficiency, but we also, on a regular basis through the University of Oregon, do surveys to make sure that our customers are satisfied with the work that we do. I'll provide you later. I don't have it for you, but we do this on an annual basis. And if the citizens of Oregon in a scientific survey are asked, how would you rate your feelings about the Oregon Department of Transportation? What we found out is more than three quarters had very positive or positive views about the department. When you talk to them about maintenance, 60% of them thought we were doing an excellent or good job when looking at maintenance. And finally, I wanted to stress that DMV, our Driver Motor Vehicle Services, if you ask how we're doing there, almost 80% of the customers are satisfied with the work we do there. And I think that's a tribute to those folks. And you'll hear from Lorna Young, who will give you some overview about what we do in DMV to make sure that our customers are satisfied with our performance. This graphic just shows the department overview of you can see that it's organized with the Transportation Commission at the top, and I'll talk about that in a moment. And then the operational divisions are down below. You're going to hear from most of those over the next couple meetings. I would also point out one thing on the very top right of this chart. If you notice the Board of Maritime Pilots, you probably don't realize that, but that is part of the Oregon Department of Transportation, and that's the pilots that get on the ships to guide them into the inland waterways at the mouth of the Columbia River. So again, a very important function. Going on to the next page,
Mr. Chairman.
Representative,
may I ask a question? On that last graphic, you show 4,844 positions and 4,686 FTEs. That's unfilled positions, vacant positions right now?
Mr. Chairman, Vice Chair Mabry, if you look at the department, this is our overall authorized full-time equivalent. At any one time, the department probably has about 5 to 6% vacancies in the positions, if I'm answering your question.
Yes, you are.
Okay.
Right. Thank you.
Very good. The next chart is what we lovingly call the bubble chart, which is really meant to, in one page, outline the sources and uses of money for the Department of Transportation. And the Department of Transportation has a very large budget. The 2003-2005 governor's balanced budget is up from last biennium. It's now $2.1 billion. And you can see the ODOT budget in the right-hand box there. It's important to note, if you look at all of the funds that come in, however, look a little bit to the left, total available revenue is about $3.2 billion. And of that, about 77% comes from state sources, 22% from federal. And I think it's very important for you to understand, if you look at what we get from the general fund of the state of Oregon, it's 0.4% of our budget, and mainly that goes to our rail and transit programs. So if you look at the ODOT budget on the right, you'll notice that it goes down, and it's mainly because of distributions to cities, counties, and other state agencies that rely on these revenue sources for their transportation needs. I'd also call your attention to the very bottom left, that box there, if you're interested how our highway funds are spent. This just gives you a breakdown of the various broad categories of where our money goes, and you can see the vast majority of our highway dollars go to maintenance, preservation, bridge, safety, and modernization, as well as pass-throughs to, again, local governments for specific projects in their areas. And we can take a lot more time on this at a later day if you'd like to, but this is a graphic that's meant to help you understand a little more easily where the money goes for the department. The next slide is just a little bit more greater explanation of the sources and uses of funds, and as you know, the revenues generated by through the ownership and operation of motor vehicles are dedicated to highways and roads in the state of Oregon. We do receive other monies from the federal government, which are more flexible in use, and you can see through here where the monies come from and which programs they go. I couldn't go through an overview without acknowledging and recognizing the Oregon Transportation Commission. And what we have is a commission made up of five members, which is appointed by the governor and then confirmed by the Oregon State Senate, who are volunteers. They are not paid. And I'll guarantee you that they spend many, many hours on transportation issues in the state of Oregon. This graphic shows you their charge per the law, but I wanted to acknowledge the members. First member is Stephen Corey, who is our chair. He's been on the commission now almost 8 years from the Pendleton area. Stuart Foster is an attorney from the Medford area. I believe he's been on almost 7 years in a position. John Russell is a commercial developer in the Portland area. Very knowledgeable in development and finance issues, and has been on the commission, I want to say, about 5 years now. And then the two newest members of the commission are Gail Achterman, who resides in Portland but probably spends most of her time in Bend with the Deschutes River Conservancy on water resource issues. So that's why we noted her as both Portland and Bend. And then finally, Randy Papay from the Papay Group out of Eugene makes up the group of the Transportation Commission. And this is a truly talented bunch of folks, and they give us great guidance and help us work through a whole lot of issues, and I just want to make sure you understand their value. The next page is an outline of what we call Area Commissions on Transportations, or again, the acronym we use, it's ACTS. And this is these are advisory groups that have been chartered by our Transportation Commission to help coordinate and address transportation issues in specific areas of the state. We put these together to help continue to build partnerships with local government and the private sector. And we use these groups in an advisory way to help advise us on transportation priorities, and they've been instrumental in involving the public in determining priorities for the State Transportation Improvement Program, which is our updated every 2 years, our capital improvement program for state highways and other modes in the state of Oregon. I think these have been a wonderful addition to the state, and they've really broken down barriers between the cities and counties and states. And I think with these advisory committees, we're constantly looking at and finding new opportunities to share resources and do things in a partnership way. The next graphic.
Mr. Chair, I have a question, Bruce, for you, just while we're on ACTS. Can you explain again, does JPAC Act, are they, in essence, an act considered by default, or can you just explain so folks here don't think that the metro area is left off this list.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and Representative Dinkfelder. Very good question. JPAC, the Joint Policy Advisory Committee on Transportation, is a group that is put together in the Portland metro area. It was the model, actually, for the act that we use statewide to get folks together of the various interests to talk about transportation. That is what we do consider that as our act in the Portland metro area. It also happens to be a metropolitan planning organization by state law, by federal law, which it gives it an even greater status. And I don't want to get into all of those details between that, but essentially JPAC is our act for the metro area, and we are working with them and the surrounding areas to determine if there needs to be another act in that area to deal with the areas outside of the metropolitan area in the Portland area.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification.
The next graphic is just a map showing those acts, and you can see, again, as Representative Dinkfelder mentioned, we say area and acts under development. There really is an act with JPAC, but there is, that whole area is not covered yet by an act, so that's a piece of work we're doing. So with that basic overview, I'm just going to give you the preview of the division areas that you're going to hear about in the next few days. I think one of the first ones that I'm personally very interested in maintaining in the state is transportation safety. And you're going to hear from Troy Costales later on this morning about the transportation safety division and what they do. Troy and his division works in partnership with other organizations to improve traffic safety. And you're going to hear about the four E's. And those are engineering, education, enforcement, and emergency response. Those four entities, people responsible for those, work together. We have in my portfolio in the department the engineering, education, some of the enforcement activities, but we do work very closely with the Oregon State Police, other emergency service providers, and other local law enforcement agencies to ensure safety. Some of the things that we work on include seatbelt safety, dealing with drunk and drug drivers, speeding, young drivers, and we have a model for the nation in terms of graduated driver's licenses for teenage drivers, which has been very effective. I think Troy will give you some information. And the bottom line is what I want to let you know is the deaths on Oregon's roads, streets, and highways for last year was 430. That's 430 too many, but I want to stress to you that it is the lowest that we've had in the state of Oregon since Eisenhower was president. And that's a great tribute to what's been going on in our work because you know what the population was 50 years ago, and the accident rates were much higher. And again, we had some years where over 700 people were being killed on our Oregon State roads and highways. So we've made some real progress here, and I'm really proud of that, and that's an area of a priority for the department. The next area you're going to hear about from Claudia Howells is the rail division, and this is one that you probably don't think about as part of the Oregon Department of Transportation, but we are responsible for regulating and assuring safety at rail crossings. Claudia's programs help prioritize and assure those projects go on. We manage passenger rail operations and coordinates the work on the high-speed rail corridor that's a priority for Canada, the state of Washington, and the state of Oregon. And we try to make sure that we understand how plans are occurring and long-range plans to deal not only with freight rail but also with passenger rail. And believe it or not, our organization also manages the safety and does inspections on rail transit facilities like light rail, trolley cars, and the streetcars in the Portland area, since they are all rail. So we're involved in those from our regulatory and safety standpoint. The driver and motor vehicle services administered by Lorna Young and her able staff. I believe there's about 2.8 million registered drivers in the state of Oregon, and their overall mission is to assure the safety, making sure that drivers their skills and knowledge are adequate. We deal with driver behavior and sanctions with some of the tools the legislature has given us. We've been very effective. This organization also is critical to assuring the titleship and ownership of motor vehicles, and making sure that fraud does not occur when vehicles are brought into the state of Oregon, and that again, it's clear that the title has brands on it to deal with damaged or total vehicles, so that people are not again led astray. And the other important thing about DMV is a major portion of their work is to collect fees that then become part of the revenues that become revenues for the state, the cities, and the counties in maintaining and preserving and expanding the transportation system. The one that I know all of you are most familiar with and probably have the most interest in is the Highway Division, and that is administered by John Rosenberger, and he's been with me in my professional career for about 10 years in various positions, and he's been in this position for about a year. And this is the organization that is responsible for the maintenance, preservation, and modernization of state highways. There is about 7,500 miles of state highways in the state of Oregon. I would stress that if you add all of the city, county, and state and federal roads together, we're a little less than 10% of the total amount of roads and highways in the state of Oregon, but our facilities carry about 60% of the traffic. And I think the numbers are 51 million miles a day are traveled in the state of Oregon on Oregon state highways. This is the organization that deals with emergency repair and ongoing maintenance, conducts bridge inspections, and delivers approximately $350 million worth of highway projects every year. And I want to stress that it's now about $450 because of the Oregon Transportation Investment Act that was approved by the legislature in their last session. So we've actually increased the output of the delivery of projects about 25% to 30%, and I want to brag a bit that we've done it without adding any new staff because we've been relying on the private sector consultants and our city and county partners to deliver these projects. We also have some special projects that you see down at the very bottom in terms of scenic byways, bicycles, pedestrian, salmon and watershed enhancements. We do a lot of culvert replacements because culvert replacements are one of the biggest impediments to anadromous fish getting up to their spawning grounds and then ultimately the juvenile fish getting back to the ocean after they've grown. So we've done some great things, and actually there's a couple areas around Oregon where fish are now in streams upstream of Oregon culverts that haven't had fish in them for 50 years. So there's some real success stories there. Motor carrier, this is the truck side of the organization. This is administered by Mr. Greg Del Ponte, and I believe you're going to hear from him. Well, this is where we register commercial vehicles, trucks, and buses, essentially allow them to operate in the state of Oregon. This is the organization that also then collects taxes and monitors and audits to make sure that the truck taxes are paid, which are make up about 36% currently, I believe, is the number of the revenues from the state side. They issue permits to deal with heavy loads and over length and over width loads. And one of the biggest things they do, again, is safety. They enforce federal safety regulations to assure that the trucks are safe, assure that the drivers are not exceeding the time behind the wheel on a daily basis. Oh, did I miss one? I'm sorry. Go back. I'm sorry. I missed one. I flipped over it. Public transit, very important. Our organization is really mostly an administrator of grants and passing money through to local organizations, both cities, counties, special service districts, county service districts, as well as nonprofits. And our job is to make sure that those folks have adequate revenues and get the money in a timely manner to be able to provide the services. The legislature, through the Oregon Transportation Network, gave the department and the state an infusion of dollars to buy new buses and vans, and we've made great progress in that. And I think you'll be very excited about some of the things we're seeing throughout the state in public transit. So I apologize for skipping over that. So we go to bridges. Let's talk about some of the challenges now that face the department. I think you've probably read the Oregonian yesterday morning talking about bridges. They've been in the news now for about 2 years. It's important to note that the bridge infrastructure in Oregon is aging. I say that it's at middle age, approaching old age. Most of the bridges that are the majority of bridges in the state of Oregon are over 50 years old. Many of them most of them were built in the 50s, 60s, and some in the late 40s. And those bridges were designed to have a 50-year design life. And here we are 50 years later, and they're starting to wear out. And the troubling thing to me is we watch them and inspect them on an annual basis, but what we're seeing is Oregon stuck with a design type of bridges that was very easy to build, very efficient to build. But what we find out is once it starts to fail, in other words, cracks in these concrete structures start to move and actually fail, they fail rather rapidly. So once they hit this useful design life, we're finding out that we have to start posting them. And we have some stories that are not pleasant around the state where we've had to reduce the loads on specific bridges. My second day on the job, I was asked to approve a reduction near the town of Roseburg on I-5. And just to give an example, in the town, little community of Riddle, it used to have 3 trucks a day going through it. It's about 1,500 people, by the way, in the little community. While we were doing emergency repairs for 6 weeks, that community had 1,500 trucks a day going through the downtown Riddle. And in other areas around the state where we've had to post bridges, it's created 150-mile detours for log trucks trying to get to mills. So you can see that this is a serious problem. And what I wanted to leave with you is that without an infusion of new dollars or with, again, essentially allowing other portions of the system to degrade more fully, with the current trend, almost 30% of the bridges in the state of Oregon, I'm talking about state, city, and county bridges, by the year 2010 will have some sort of load restrictions. That will have a major impact on the economy of the state of Oregon. So we're very worried about that. We just presented a report to the commission that outlined if you want to solve all of the problem, it's about a $4.7 billion problem. We are recommending a strategy that deals with $1.7 billion of critical freight and lifeline routes for the state, city, and county, and we hope to have discussions with you about how we can solve that problem, but more to come on that. Another just general observation is it's not just the bridges, the pavements and roadways. It's hard to believe, again, that the interstate system was built in the 50s and 60s, and you travel those roadways, and you see that we're now having to do major pavement rehabilitation to keep them in operation. It's not unlike a house that's 50 or 60 years old. You need to do major repairs, install a new roof every 20 or 30 years, and it's not unlike that on the interstate. And we're starting to see that throughout the state. Local governments in the state have done a great job of holding the system together, but we have received no new money in terms of increased revenues for maintenance and operation at any level for over a decade. The Oregon Transportation Investment Act was great, but I want to stress it all went to capital. It all went to improvements to the system, not to maintenance. So this is an issue we'll want to talk to you about some more. This is one, the next one is one that you undoubtedly have heard about or will hear about, which is access management. This is where we, as trying to maintain the mobility and safety of the transportation system to assure freight and goods can move from one part of the state to another and through the state, we need to balance the desires and needs of access for property with those through movements on our facilities. And we are doing a lot of work to try to balance that and improve the way we manage access. But this is an issue that often becomes contentious. I want to let you know that we deal with most of the issues of access in a very amicable way and come to an agreement about where access should be or how to reduce accesses into a consolidated way to make it safer. But there are a limited number of those where people believe they need to have access to maintain the viability of their land or their business. And again, we're trying desperately to make sure we understand where we can allow congestion and more access to occur that doesn't impact statewide mobility, and again, where we need to protect the system from those additional accesses. And I think you'll hear more about that, and there is an issue paper I'll give you a little later that talks about that. Finally, I want to recognize you and the legislature for directing the department to do some things over the interim that I think are very important to the future of transportation in Oregon. First off is the Road User Fee Task Force. The legislature in the last session recognized that the fleet is becoming more and more fuel efficient. There's more and more hybrid vehicles that are being on the road, gasoline, electric vehicles. And frankly, the world is going to run out of petroleum products sometime soon, and so we need to look at new ways to fund transportation, and reliance on the gas tax may not be the best way. So the legislature asked us to put together a road user fee task force to look at alternatives to how we would fund transportation. I think you've seen some articles and editorials in the paper talking about the vehicle mile traveled concept. But, you know, it also, this group is also looking at things like congestion pricing, which is essentially tolls on roadways during specific times to encourage folks to not drive on those during the peak hours, tolls in general. And, Mr. Chair, they're still talking about studded tires and the impact and how we ought to deal with that. But this is, you have some material attached trying to give you a summary about what they're doing in this area. But this is exciting because I think the whole nation is starting to realize the need to figure out other ways to fund transportation in the future. The next one is the Innovative Finance Advisory Committee. This was as a result of Senate Bill 966, which its genesis came from Senator Clarno and the Milliken Road proposal linking up Bend and Prineville, trying to find out new and innovative ways that we could involve the private sector and their funding and expertise in development of transportation infrastructure in the state of Oregon. And what the Senate Bill 966 did is gave us some more opportunities and tools to partner with the private sector to provide transportation improvements. And they were looking, as an example, like the airport light rail expansion from Gateway to the airport, which was funded, designed, and built entirely by the Bechtel Corporation in exchange for future lease revenues from Ford-owned property near the Port of Portland. And I think what we're trying to do is figure out ways to encourage that kind of partnership and innovation on other types of transportation projects throughout the state of Oregon. And this committee has made a report to the previous Transportation Committee last year, but I suspect we'll see some recommendations from them that will allow us to maybe enter into other agreements and partnerships in the future. I really view this as an opportunity. And then finally, what I wanted to talk to you about is I do want to recognize when you look at that bubble chart of our funding, almost 30% of our funding comes from the federal government. And this next year, Congress will be considering enacting a new transportation bill that will set the priorities and funding for transportation funded by the federal government for the next 6 years. We've been very involved in that. Obviously, we're talking to them about our bridges, those issues. But what we want to do is make sure, as this graphic shows, that the overall federal highway and transit funding be increased, as it has in all the past reauthorizations, that we still maintain the trust, the firewalls, and the integrity of the Highway Trust Fund. We fought for years to make sure that transportation revenues go to transportation projects. And we'd like to figure out a way to make sure that Oregon is a winner in the distribution of the funds. In other words, we don't become a donor state, and we're just essentially getting about what we put in right now. And we believe that this is very important. We're also asking for maybe some more flexibility to start dealing with rail projects in the state of Oregon. And the problem, of course, is that without new money, that takes away from other things. So we're working very hard with our congressional delegation to come up with an act that works, and Congress is going to be starting debates probably in the next 2 months on that. I would point out that I've given you some issue papers on those last three items that I talked about, and we have some other issue papers that we put together for the new governor, which the administrators of each individual program will go over, that I think you'll find informative and instructive in some of the issues that are confronting Oregon. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I will conclude and allow you to ask me any questions.
Thank you, Bruce. Any questions? Representative Zahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bruce, last year I saw a map that showed the quarries that we own, rock quarries, mm-hmm. in addition to the public sector. Are there some of those that we could sell off and get some revenue? I realize some are storage places, like on Mount Hood for gravel and stuff. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Zahner. We do have a number of quarry sites around the state of Oregon. Many of them date back to when we built the roads originally. Those were our original sources of rock when we built the roads around various parts of the state. Every year we surplus an amazing amount of right-of-way per the direction of the legislature, and we are always looking at those quarry sites to determine if they're viable sources of rock or should we get rid of them. Many of them we've retained just as an option for the contractors to use as sources of rock for repair and rehabilitation projects. But there's been a number of them sold, and if you remember at last legislative session, probably why you saw that map is because we had asked for a new position to help us manage an inventory and actually take a hard look at those sites to see which ones we needed to retain, which ones we needed to work with local governments to make sure we could utilize them, and frankly, which ones we needed to surplus. So I'd be glad to go over that list again with you in some more detail if you'd like.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Richard.
Representative Green.
Thank you for that briefing. I guess you need to help me a bit.
Sure.
Help you. campaigning in Washington County for the last through several campaigns, I continue to hear about ODOT, and I'm intrigued with your survey results that show most people are, and they're obviously the silent majority, because the minority aren't silent at all about ODOT. And I really wish. I mean, I got an email yesterday that really typifies the kind of response that I tried to answer rather than forwarding. Maybe you can give me your email so I can just forward them straight to you or something.
I'd be glad to.
But yeah, I mean, it said, oh, I think ramp lights are stupid on the freeway. They cause trouble. Nobody thinks that they really work. And I've called ODOT 3 times, and all they tell me is that they really help. They won't explain anything. That's just their sort of answer. Now, I don't necessarily believe that. And my answer to him was, it's my impression that ramp lights do help and that congestion would be worse. But what is it about ODOT that seems to draw the kind of ire of my Washington County half of my district? I mean, it's just at every coffee I hear about ODOT. And they're mostly wrong. I mean, it's not that they are mostly right.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Greenlake, I appreciate your candor and bringing those issues up. I don't know whether you know about my background. I spent 15 of my professional years in Washington County and really worked with my deputy that's in charge of highways now and coming up with ways to solve the transportation woes of Washington County. And there's a county which needed to play catch-up in many, many ways to deal with the growth that was occurring there. And frankly, that county had undervested dramatically in the transportation, allowed growth to go ahead without dealing with the impacts of transportation. And we're playing catch-up still. And if you ask folks if they're satisfied with the system there in terms of congestion, anybody who's on the Sunset Highway would not feel that we have adequate capacity. The good news is that, as for example, because of the Oregon Transportation Investment Act, we're going to be doing some major widening on the Sunset Highway. But what you're seeing, I think, is a frustration with traffic in general. And we are doing things to manage the system to try to eke out as much of capacity as we can. And people don't like ramp meters. There's no question about that. But they don't like sitting in stalled traffic either. And I was actually with the Oregon Department of Transportation when we put those ramp meters in. They were done under my leadership. And we saw remarkable increases in the flow of traffic. And if those weren't there, instead of the congestion on the local streets, they'd be piled up on the freeways. So those issues and issues of access and development, when access development is hot and people are building, we have a lot of state highways in Washington County, as an example, which don't look like state highways anymore. I mean, you look at the 12 Valley Highway, you look at Beaverton-Hillsdale Highway, they really function as county or city roads now, and we need to recognize that, and frankly, I'd like to allow the local governments to have control of those roadways, so they can deal with some of these issues, and we can focus on the mobility from a statewide and interstate way. There's lots of issues. I'd love to go over the results of our polling so I understand that it is scientific. I think you are hearing from the folks who are interested and involved, but let's face it, transportation is critical to everybody in the state of Oregon, and I think in Washington County it's even risen to a higher level.
Mr. Chair, if I may follow up on that. Sir.
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, but I mean, I wonder if some of it is an attitudinal problem rather than our staff got staff training here, and they were shown the Bob Farrell slide called "Give 'em the Pickle" on how to respond to requests, and the staff in this building, incidentally, I found are quite remarkable in doing that. One of your folks was at Senator then Rep. Ringo had a town hall on transportation, and your staff was enormously knowledgeable and helpful and did a great job, actually, in that, from my perspective. But still the attitude is, these problems are just too complex for you to understand as a normal citizen. And, if we had a lot of time, I'd explain it to you, but we don't have all the time. So the answer is, we're engineers, and we know what we're doing. And we're here to help you.
That's one of my priorities, Representative, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, is that that's the customer satisfaction part of the organization. And it is attitudinal. I agree. ODOT has been a very insular organization in the past. And I hope that over the past few years, the people have seen a change in the department and the way we respond. The area commissions on transportation are examples where we are out trying to engage in a productive dialogue to understand issues before and actually build understanding. My organization has been made up over the years of engineers. I happen to be an engineer. And sometimes our engineers are not the greatest communicators of issues. but that is a priority, and I think we're making great progress, and we're trying to hire staff in key positions that have not only the technical skills but also the people skills to be able to communicate and deal with folks. And those examples are exactly, if you see those are the kind of things that I and my management staff need to know about so we can deal with those immediately. The organization is very protective of the state highway system. And we need to, again, step back in many ways, and I think we are, trying to make sure that we're balancing the needs of all. And the statewide mobility is one of the considerations, as an example, that we take into account when we look at an application for an access or anything else. We're getting better, but we're still not there. And with your help, maybe we can get there. And I would appreciate your input and thoughts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mabry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bruce, it was nice to hear you say after 15 years of Washington County, you take personal responsibility for Representative Greenlee.
Well, I did want to let him know.
Maybe that's not what you did. I would just say to that issue, having served in Wasco County for a lot of years and worked with the transportation issues that we have in the Lower John Day Partnership, ODOT enjoys a great reputation in our area, very cooperative. Not trouble-free, but nothing rarely is. So I commend you for that. My question, however, is going back to your slide regarding transportation safety. One of the things you talked about was partnering with state police and local police for safety programs. And that question prompts question I get regularly, and I guess at one time the OSP was funded from transportation dollars. They no longer are. Do you think there's any merit to having that link of OSP? We've seen OSP go up and down and up and down with the political issues of funding and what have you. And it's just, there's no trap here. I'm just curious to know, in your personal opinion, do you think there should be a tie, or is it better the way it is, separated from each other?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mabry, I'm trying to answer that in two ways. I think, first off, there is clearly a programmatic and need to work very closely together with the Oregon State Police. And, in fact, I've encouraged co-location of Oregon State Police facilities with our maintenance facilities, because there's a great synergy there where they work together and again deal with issues out on the road, because we know each other, we can respond. you're right. And I think it was 1978 when the voters approved the constitutional amendment that, again, mandated the fees for motor vehicles to go to highways and roads, which, again, took the Oregon State Police out of that funding. They are an integral part of highway safety in Oregon, and I am worried about the highway patrol functions and traffic functions being a lower priority than other areas. So I'm very worried about that. I don't have an answer. Obviously, the voters and you have the ability to change those and redirect funds. And I think that will probably be a topic of discussion before the legislature. So we need them. They have to be part of the system to make the system work.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Bruce, in White City, I think ODOT and the Jackson County maintenance people are co-located. Mm-hmm. I see some savings in that, and I just wondered if it's happening anyplace else around the state.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Gilman, Medford and Jackson County is the most aggressive place that we have done essentially joint facilities and joint sharing of capital assets. We, throughout the state, in various places like Washington County, again, I'll use an example, we have agreements between the cities and counties where we share equipment on a regular basis. Actually, if you go out on a job in Washington County, as an example, you'll see city equipment, state equipment, county equipment working on a city road or a state highway or whatever else. That is the only area where we actually have currently a joint facility. I want to see more of those, and I think I don't know whether I've talked with Judge Mabry when he was a judge in Wasco County, but I believe those are ways that we ought to save money and be more efficient, because frankly the citizens of the state of Oregon don't care whether it's a city road, a state highway, or a county road. They want to call a number and have somebody take care of their problem. We need to look at more of those kind of facilities, and I have encouraged and had conversations with a couple counties who are very interested in doing that because of the lack of resources to do their job adequately, and that's one of the things that I think is beneficial about holding the money constant and having, again, us having to scratch to look for money is also we're looking at some of those things that maybe we didn't look when we all had the money we needed to do the work. So we don't have as many of those as I would like, but the good news is I think a number of folks are talking about it, and I think you'll see more in the very near future.
Is there any other questions?
Mr. Chair, a follow-up on Representative Gilman's question, Bruce. Who made the overture? Who said, let's try to get together in Roseburg to make that work? Did you guys do that, or did the city or county, or how did that happen?
You know, I don't know who actually uttered the words first in Jackson County, but I will tell you it's because of the relationship and the working relationship between Paul Mather, who is the region manager in that particular area, and why have I lost his name? Oh, thank you. Yes, Joe Strahl, who is the Director of Public Works for Jackson County. And those people, because they're dedicated professionals, looked at each other and said, there's opportunities to do things differently. Usually what we find out is in these cases, the best time and the opportunity is when somebody needs a new facility or their facility is wearing out and they need to make some sort of major capital investment. So those things pop up as a result of that. And I don't know whether this was a case, because it wasn't done when I was at ODOT, whether that was the case of the county needing some new facilities or us needing some new facilities, but I suspect that's what started to drive that discussion. So I can't answer your question, but I'd be glad to get Paul Mather up here and give you a little more history on that if you'd like.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you. Well, Bruce, just to wrap it up, myself and our committee is very much looking forward to working with you during this session, and we realize there's a number of huge transportation issues, particularly with the bridges and other infrastructure that we have throughout the state that we have the responsibility of dealing with in this session. And I know through your department and with this committee, we're going to come out with some hopefully some productive means of dealing with these issues, and I'm really looking forward to working with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking forward to working with you, too. Thank you all.
Thank you. Thank you again,
Bruce.
Bruce.
Thank you, Bruce.
Troy Costellos. Welcome, Troy. Good to see you again.
Give me just a moment to switch over and see
you're
if
hooked
we can
up there.
Make this work correctly for you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Troy Costellos. I'm manager of the Transportation Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. Glad to be with you this morning. I, too, have brought a PowerPoint slideshow for you, and the slides in your packet will go along right with what are on the screen. I'd like to cover two things. First, just a quick description of the Safety Division, what we're responsible for, what we try and work on, and then actually spend a majority of the time talking about the status of safety in the state of Oregon. And Director Warner did a great job of giving you an opening and a little bit of conversation on where we're heading and what we're working on and what the priorities are. And I'd like to take you through some of those things that we've had some great success the past 4 or 5 years, and some things that are up and coming that are unfortunately going to be giving us some trouble, as Representative Mavery actually commented on with law enforcement and how that may have an impact. Within the division, there are the four areas that we'll cover quickly: staff and budget, our responsibility as a grant authority and sending out funds, state agencies and local agencies and nonprofit agencies across the state, what we're expected to do as far as being a place of topic expertise and subject matter and interpretations of rules and laws, and then our role and responsibility in relationship to the media, to legislation, and when we deal with the federal office as one of the branches of the U.S. Department of Transportation. The Safety Division is very small. We have a total of 25 positions in the Safety Division, and only two of those are in management. Quite often, we get a question about the people in the division because they're called program managers. That's because they manage programs such as impaired driving or bicycle or pedestrian or things. The manager title on the business card is not because they're in management. It's because they're in charge of a particular area. Sometimes, unfortunately, there's a misperception about all the management staff that are in the division. There are only two. Five of these positions are in the field. We have done a co-location of safety staff, one in each of the five highway regions. And they are in with the traffic manager or the traffic engineer of each of the five highway region offices. And that was something that was initiated and started in 1997. And 3 years ago, we finally got the last one put in place by looking at using vacant positions and transferring in and making those types of things happen instead of coming forward and asking for more FTE for the overall department or the division. The biennial budget, as approved by the governor and forwarding to Ways and Means, is $23.7 million. About 60% of that is federal. The other 40% is through state sources. The two big programs that we have responsibility for that are state-oriented are the motorcycle safety program, which is mandated for anybody under the age of 21 that is wanting to get an endorsement for a motorcycle license, and the state's driver education program. The 1999 session, there was a bill that put in place the teen driving law and at the same time moved the responsibility for driver education from the Department of Education to the safety office. Those two programs make up literally almost all of the state money that our office has. The rest of the money that we receive is from the U.S. Department of Transportation, from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, and I'll use the phrase NHTSA. That's the group that does the crash testing on cars. They're the ones that do a lot of data, but they also have a program that sends money to the state that is used in the highway safety program and they have a particular process and rules and regulations around those funds about how we spend them in highway safety. The safety division also has a tremendous amount of citizen advisory committees. We work with three governor-appointed committees. One, the Oregon Transportation Safety Committee, that is led by Dr. John Tung. That group, up until 1991, was actually the board. The safety office was in the governor's office until 1991 and then was moved into ODOT. When that move occurred, the safety committee became advisory to the commission and advisory to the department on safety matters. The two other governor committees, one's a governor's advisory committee on motorcycle safety. It exists in the governor's office, but we're responsible for it. The third is the governor's advisory committee on DUII, which is also in the governor's office, but the safety division is responsible for helping them and working with them. There are about 15 other citizen advisory committees that are out there in all the different programs that we work on, and you'll see some of those examples as we come through. Our program is steeped in citizen involvement and being involved in the policy and the decision-making process, and that is actually part of the NHTSA requirement to get and spend the federal funds. So Oregon does a very good job of doing that.
Mr. Chair,
I just have a
quick question for you, Troy. Could you just repeat what the breakdown of federal and state? I know you said the state portion was very small, but can you just repeat those numbers for me, please?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dingfelder, approximately 60% of that budget is federal funds and 40% is state funds. And the two major pieces of state funds are the motorcycle safety program and the driver education program.
All right, thank you. And that's of the 23.7 million. That's your total budget, right, with federal and state?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dingfelder, that is correct. That includes all staff costs and everything.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Troy.
You're welcome. Bottom line, the main thing we have to make sure we do day in and day out is in the grant management area. There is a multiple set of categories of funds, both on the state side, as I mentioned, a few of them, and on the federal side. Every single one of them have a different set of rules, a different set of priorities, what we can use the money for, what we cannot use the money for. And so we have to try and juggle the different pots of funds in order to make sure that our projects get done and we're using the correct sources of funds in the correct manner and that we have correct oversight of the funds. In 1997, the federal government backed out of the auditing oversight role and put it on top of the individual state offices to make sure that they're spending the money correctly and using the money correctly. And so we've had to step up and have in place and have done a good job of making sure that our money is spent, that it's put in the right places, and that we have the correct backup for when we reimburse expenses for the grants. We interpret a tremendous amount of federal and state rules on behalf of the grantees, on behalf of the general citizenry. One of the things I'll mention here in a minute is the safety office tends to take on a role of a place where the citizens call when a new law goes in, like the teen driving law or the booster seat law or felony DUI or issues about, for a while we had some concerns about the high-intensity discharge headlights, the very bright or blue headlights. What's the rules on those headlights? Can they have them? Can they not have them? We tend to get those calls into our office and help interpret either the federal rule for vehicles or state rules for a lot of the other programs. One thing to note in the grant management area, particularly in the federal side, the future, and as Director Warner mentioned about the next reauthorization of the six-year federal bill, Congress is giving us clues that they're very likely going to go away from having a highway safety bucket given to the state, you spend it on the problems you see you have, alcohol or drugs or speed or belts. What Congress is looking like they're doing is they're going to pre-choose the stream of money and the color of money that the states are going to get. This is your alcohol piece. This is your speed piece. This is your belt piece. This is your distracted driver piece. And what that does is ends up tying our hands to some degree. Because if we do have a priority unique to our state that we need to shuffle to put more money towards, we may not have the ability to. And so it's one thing we're trying to watch and make sure that our delegates in Congress know what our priorities are in the state, where we need to be able to spend the money to make the difference as we've been doing the last 4 years. Topically, we have statutory responsibility, and that's left over because of the office being in the governor's office. We are called to do specific jobs. in bicycle safety, pedestrian safety, DUI, and a few other places, we have to fulfill that statutory charge. As I mentioned, we have multiple advisory committees. We do a tremendous amount of training around the state, and that's where quite a bit of our funds go, either to pay for the training so it's no or low cost to law enforcement or to local traffic engineers or to local community members or health and human services staff in order to make help them understand what their responsibility is and to do a better job. We do field a tremendous amount of citizen calls, and we do have one annual conference. This upcoming October will be in Eugene. Just recently we were in Tigard. It's a place for 250 or so people that attend from all of the education, engineering, and enforcement areas that Director Warner talked about come together to try and solve local problems. And then we hold and do special workshops for law enforcement. We have a grant with Oregon State University so that during the year there are 8 courses that local traffic engineers can go to learn how to deal with rumble strips or how to do a better job of striping. Do they use the regular paint or the durable paint? How do we deal with 911 and the infrastructure of the phone company? How do you deal with replacing mailboxes when you repave a road? What kind of stanchions do you use? Because citizens have an interesting desire to have unique and different mailbox settings. To help the local traffic staff who may not have had that training go to a place at low or no cost to get that training, as one example. Press releases and media events and public service announcements. We spend in any one year about $300,000 to create public service announcements. We do not pay for the posting. We do not pay for airtime. We do not pay for TV time. We do not pay for the billboard space. We create them. We, in turn, for our $300,000 of creating things around the topics you'll see in a second, we receive just under $4 million of donated space and time. One of the concerns about what Congress is looking at is mandating states to pay for TV time to advertise safety belt use or to advertise don't drink and drive. We don't have a big enough budget to pay for the time and space we get donated, so we're in a big negotiation with NHTSA to try and get out from underneath that, give us a loophole to be able to deal with that. The past two sessions, there have been about 700 bills that have had some connection to highway safety, and 93 of those were passed and signed into law, and have some examples in a second about some of the successes we've experienced the past few sessions. And we deal a lot with agency partners of city, county, state, nonprofit, local community groups all around the state. Why do we do all this work, and how is the organization set up and the money spent? What difference are we trying to make in the state of Oregon? And this is a set of series of slides to show you that we are making a difference, and all of us partnering together are doing a great job. In 1995, there was a 15-year goal to try and have our state fatality rate at 1.3 based on population and vehicles and the amount of cars on the road. In 1998, the Traffic Safety Committee, led by Dr. Tung, realized that we were getting there pretty fast, so backed up and said we should probably meet that goal by 2000. We met the goal in 1999. In 4 years, we saw a 20% reduction in the number of fatalities on Oregon's roads and streets, and set a new goal of trying to get to 0.99, which is one of the most aggressive in the United States, by 2010. If we do that, in a 15-year time period, we will have reduced the number of fatalities on Oregon's roads and streets by 43% in 15 years. Impaired driving. In the 1999 session, legislature passed and was signed into law felony DUI, in part because there was concern of seeing somebody cited for driving under the influence the fourth time, the fifth time, the sixth time, killing somebody, and looking at the record and finding out this person had 7 or 8 prior DUIs, and they're out there on the road, and somebody's killed, or they kill themselves. Legislature stepped in 1999 and said, enough's enough. If you hit your fourth DUI in a 10-year time period, it is raised to the level of felony, and all of the fines and jail time and things that go with that. That Oregon is in the majority of states that do have a felony DUI. However, when our felony DUI comes into play, we're one of the later states There are states that have them come in on the second or the third, not the fourth in 10 years. The responsibility for publishing this, the responsibility for training law enforcement, prosecutors, and courts about this bill, part of that came to us. And that's what in those years, 99 and 2000, we used part of our grant money for, was to get distributed training out and around the state. In 2000, 38% of all the fatalities in the state were alcohol-related. It's 175. 175 people in 2000 lost their lives in drinking driving crashes. In 2001, we continued to push and lowered it, and it went down to 35%, which is the lowest we have ever had since 1970, since we've been tracking alcohol crashes in this state.
Mr. Chair, can I ask Troy a question? What areas did most of those accidents occur? Around the casinos, around Portland, around out in the country? Or do you have that statistic?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Zahner, I do have a publication with me, which is a set of data over the last 11 years by county as to where the crashes occur. I'd be happy to give it to you after the session.
Thank you, Troy.
Okay.
Thank
you. One for everybody?
Okay.
Mark that down. Even with the 35.5%, which is the lowest we've had, that still meant 173 in 2001. I don't have 2002 figures for you. I will show a slide in a minute about what the total was last year, as Director Warner mentioned. But alcohol and toxicology and drug screens are usually the last things that get into the database because they go through all of the criminal process and everything, and they usually are available in about April or May, and we can make a statement then about how we looked like in 2002. An interesting point, and that's that bottom bullet. Mm-hmm. We have an issue with drug-impaired drivers. They are now representing 8 to 10% of the fatal crashes in this state where somebody is under the influence of drugs other than alcohol. We have set up a program and sponsored with state police and a lot of jurisdictions around the state to put in place what are called drug recognition experts, special trained officers that have a DRE PIN, that they are trained to understand and deal with people that are under the influence of drugs other than alcohol. And they are out there. They are out there to the tune of 100 a month are stopped because of their driving behavior. They don't have alcohol in the system. They have drugs. And one of the concepts that the Governor's DUI Committee has forwarded, which is in the back of that packet, which actually is assigned to the House, I have no idea which committee it's going to yet, but it's to talk about the conversation of Oregon's definition of DUI. We have a very narrow definition of DUI. There are drivers out there that are under the influence of drugs, either over-the-counter prescription that they are abusing, or home-cooked things that are not being charged with DUI. They're being charged with reckless or endangering, but not DUI because our DUI definition is so narrow. So these people have a need to be looked at, evaluated, possibly treated. They're stopped by the officer, removed off the road, but they aren't getting the treatment because they're not fitting underneath the definition of Oregon's DUI law.
Mr. Chair? I have a question for Troy. What is the... It's a two-part question, actually. What's the penalty differences, I said on judiciary last session, but I can't remember, between the if you're stopped for DUI versus reckless driving under the influence of a drug-related substance?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Dingfelder, the penalties related to fines and suspension of license are the same. What is different is that the reckless or endangering does not go through looking at and being evaluated whether they have an abuse problem or not. That a DUI person must go through. A DUI person must be evaluated by a professional through the court and very likely is set up and goes through treatment that they pay for or the Indigent Defense Fund pays for, the alcohol funds pay for. Reckless, they don't get into that system at all. They'll come before the judge and be charged and have their license suspended and pay fines, but they don't get the treatment fees.
Follow-up question to that? And I also want to make a statement for the record that I find it really disheartening that we're actually cutting back on our drug and alcohol treatment programs because, as we all know, it's very much related, and it's hard to get these people off the road if they have some serious addiction problems to begin with. But is there, do you know, is ODOT working with the justice system on changing that? I mean, I'm assuming that has to be done through statute or exploring that at this point as far as, because it seems like we're getting treatment to people who are obviously under the influence of alcohol but not other substances.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Dinkfelder, so there is a legislative concept that is forwarded through the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUI, and the Commission has also supportive of it, and that is House Bill 2199, which is about the fourth page from the back. It's the first page that has the print going across that updates that definition to try and at least have the conversation about, do we want to start to have those individuals that are under the influence of those other drugs brought into the DUI system.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
May I follow up on that, Mr. Chair?
Representative Green.
My understanding is most of the folks who get diverted through that program pay their own way through treatment, but the problem is that the drug courts are being closed down. And I wonder if there's any way to transfer highway safety money to keep the drug courts open, or because I really agree with Representative Dinkfelder, that's a huge problem if we slow that down. I think we've been extremely successful on our diversion programs.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Greenlick, there are some funds through the Safety Division that go towards courts. We are currently funding a program in Multnomah County Court for the repeat DUI offenders, so they have intense supervision from the probation and the treatment. And normally, across the U.S., for somebody that is going to repeat and reoffend for DUI, it's about a 30% reoffend rate for those that go through. About one-third of them, you'll see them again at some time in 10 years. The program that we're funding in Multnomah County has a 1% reoffend rate right now. Our funds usually go pay for a pilot or a test because we have so few funds. And we hope that it shows success that others will try and repeat it elsewhere in the state. To my knowledge, we've not done anything specific with drug courts. The piece we'd have to watch is to make sure that the program that we fund is related to the offenders of driving under the influence of drugs, not methamphetamine labs and things like that that don't have anything to do with travel. But if there is an opportunity to deal with a grant to that program, we would warrant it. We've not had a link up on that, to my knowledge, at least for the last 5 years. What if we were successful and put in place some laws and some programs and some things in order to help people not drink and drive, and we drove and moved that number down to 30%? We're talking about 35 lives per year that would be saved. Still, unfortunately, 30% would be alcohol-related, but that difference is well worth the effort for 35 lives. Safety belts. Safety belts is another program priority. This is a snapshot of a billboard along I-84 in eastern Oregon. Oregon boasts one of the highest safety belt use rates in the nation. We have been, for the last 4 or 5 years, one of the top 3 or 4 states. 90% to 91% of our citizens wear their safety belt, and that's all positions in the car. The other thing that we can boast is Oregon has the only citizen initiative, citizen voted primary safety belt law in the entire U.S. It was voted in 1990. All the other states that have safety belt laws were legislated into being. In Oregon, we voted it in. And that vote actually was at the same ballot as Measure 5, and the safety belt law got more votes than Measure 5 did back in 1990.
I hope so.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Garner.
Troy, how come women buckle up more than guys? They slide in easier,
sure,
or they?
Can I answer that question?
I got to find this out. I have 3 daughters and 1 son, so I got to solve this dilemma right here. Give me an answer for that,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Zahn. I hope that was a rhetorical question. generally, it is it's an attitude, it's a behavior. It's women tend to have the attitude of being the protector, the caretaker, and safety belts is one of those ways I remember as a child, my mom would try to slow down fast. What's the first thing she did? Be like that. My dad was driving. You know, first thing he did, tried to swerve around the car that was in front of him. I just think it's an attitude and a behavior. Women do buckle up. That's about 93%, and men are 89 to 90, and that which is still very, very high and very good. But it's just it's been the way all the way through, 2 or 3 percentage points.
You handle that one well.
I would just say seatbelt enforcement works, at least in my case. I left a store parking lot about a year and a half ago and failed to buckle up my seatbelt and got a $77 reminder. And the proof of the fact that it works is that I was at the time working in the courthouse right next to the court system. As I was walking down the hall from the restroom, I passed two police officers, walked into my office, sat down at my desk, and reached for my seatbelt.
Representative Gilman.
Chair, you have statistics here on men and women. What about youth, younger drivers? I'm kind of curious. I'll bet they buckle up more, too.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gilman, when we look at the use, how we do that is we have a research firm that, in order to be statewide surveyed, they actually are standing on the side of the road and looking in the car. So age sometimes becomes a little bit difficult as far as being able to tell. For the younger children, for the 4 to 15-year-old group, they're at 95%. For teenagers or young adults, it's difficult to age break them. So we look at the other side and we look at the crash results in fatal crashes, because we know those are investigated fully to find out who was wearing belts. And Oregon has one of the top two young adult belt use rates when we look at crash numbers, which through all the math says that means they're buckling up. And to reach 91%, it's all ages have got to be buckling up. There's really not a sector of age, really a population in the state that's holding out. One issue, though, to bring up, and it's that last bullet. We had 10, 12 years ago when we first put in child safety seats and then recently about booster seats, we did a great job of educating people, parents and grandparents, about seats. Unfortunately, the parents of today, particularly the younger parents of today, weren't involved in that media push, weren't involved in that conversation. They were kids themselves. So we are starting to see a rise in the number of children that are just free and loose in the car. And part of the response from those parents are, want them to be happy, don't want to have them restrained. And what they don't realize is that they're putting that child at tremendous risk if that car ever just leave the road or crash, because that child is loose. So we're working with county health departments and others around the state in order to do car seat clinics, car seat giveaways, or making, you know, at low cost $20 vouchers to buy a seat that we'll subsidize through insurance companies or Ford Motor Company, others. We try and get that money to come in order to infuse it into the communities to make the seats available all over the state.
Mr. Chair,
it's an honor.
Troy, in my district, in my city of Woodburn in particular, we have a high Hispanic population, a lot of them coming in that don't speak the language well, and we, through our Kiwanis clubs, try to get them involved. We give seats and helmets to the little kids on bikes and stuff. But in your statistics, does it show, again, an area or maybe an ethnic group or population? Would Maya Hispanics in my area be causing more of this because they're not used to doing it down in Mexico or where they came from?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Zahner, all of our information about those situations described are all anecdotal, because we can't tell when observing somebody their heritage or their language. But we have done some specific outreach in Russian as well as Spanish as well as various Asian languages. And we try and work with the clinics. And in Woodburn, you have clinics there. And so we try and outreach through those groups or through pediatricians, the doctors. Because quite often, as you mentioned, the family heritage and the upbringing, they've got certain mindsets and ways of doing things and who they will listen to. Sometimes it's not law enforcement. That's actually the opposite. It's the grandparents, it's particularly the grandmother, or it's the nurses or the doctors or school teachers. So in those communities, what we try and do is set up a training specifically for those people, because they are the ones that are going to get the message across, not the government and not police. So we try and recognize that, and there is more to go, and you are correct. With the infusion and continued turnover and migration of people, we can't step back and say we're done, because it's something new every day.
Thank you, correct. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
If we were to increase our safety belt use from 91 to 95, that means 30 lives each year saved across the state on Oregon's roads and streets. This is not Oregon. I'm not sure if this is Vermont or Hawaii or just somebody's figment of their imagination, but the reason for this picture is this, and that is that speed is an issue in this state. We are a rural state, and unfortunately, for the last 3 years, speed too fast for conditions or speeding has now surpassed drinking and driving as the number one cause of fatal crashes in this state. We are looking at roughly 43%, 200 people the last couple of years that are involved in crashes where they are going too fast. One interesting thing to note is looking at just the convictions posted through the court system sent to DMV, almost 250,000 people in 2001, were convicted of speeding of some sort. It is pervasive. It is something that people believe they have the right to do and that they're under their own control. What we have not done very well is explain the dangers of what that means. And the Governor's Transportation Safety Committee and Dr. Tung and others are starting to do that and work with local civic groups to describe this, because it has really jumped up very dramatically. As we've pushed alcohol down, speed has gone up.
Troy, does these safety zones make any difference? Do you have any statistics for them?
Mr. Chairman, the safety corridors, yes. I think you're referring to, yes. Mm-hmm. The safety corridors do make a difference only if there is the signing, there is the businesses in the area advertise it, there's law enforcement in the zone to reinforce the signs, and where we have the ability, we do some of the engineering changes, possibly like rumble strips on the edge, or like on US 26, rumble strips in the middle because of head-on crashes, people crossing the median. They work if you do all the pieces concentrated on that zone. If we just simply put up signs, it does not work.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Donner.
Relating to speed again, last year, last session when we tried to do that 70-mile-an-hour speed limit bill, all the statistics showed it wasn't speed. It was the difference in speed on the speedways at least. If everybody was doing 80 miles an hour and nobody changed lanes, you wouldn't have the accidents. It's when someone's going 55 or 60 and someone's doing 70 and the constant changing of lanes. And the second part of that question is, are most of the accidents occurring on 99E and 99W, because that's where you have all your speed corridors and your safety corridors and you don't have them on the freeway. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Zahner, to both questions, speed differential is a concern. The higher you raise the upper speed, the broader range of traveling the cars will be in that zone. And speed differential, and with closing speed, particularly on vehicles that are exiting or slowing down to exit, and as we age as drivers in this state, our perception of how far things are away or how fast we're closing on them becomes more difficult. Speed differential is a concern. Where are the speed-related crashes? They are on the rural county roads and the rural state highways. Those are the two areas where it is concerned, predominantly built for lower volume of speed or lower volume of cars, and there's a tremendous number of access points and driveways that all those things bring up the conflict on the street.
Thank you, Troy. Troy, I know out on Highway 18 out by the casino, that safety corridor there is... when it was implemented, there was a sunset on it. We renewed it last year. Is there other safety corridors around state that have that the sunset on it also that we need to look at?
Mr. Chairman, there has been two of the safety corridors on a pilot test were identified as having double fines within that safety corridor, and both of those are due to sunset at the end of this calendar year. Unless there is a renewed application or renewed movement by the legislature. We did not pre-file a bill in order to extend the sunset because at the time we didn't have our studies in. We just, 2 weeks ago, received the study on whether the double fine works or not. Unfortunately, both of those double fine corridors are on stretches of road that are what's called violation of basic rule, not speed limit. And basic rule means that it's up to the officer to describe to the judge all of the things going on at the time, and the number on the sign is just guidance. And in one of the double fine areas, it splits two counties, and we've had very different judicial treatment of those double fines on one side versus the other. And that impacted in part what the public felt and in part what did happen in that double fine, and so the study is not all that promising, but there's a couple of reasons, I believe, why in those particular areas. If the Sheriff, you'd like to see the study and have a conversation about whether this committee wants to talk about extending the sunset, we can do that.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gilman.
I suppose you're going to give me some good reason for the 55-mile-an-hour speed zone through Salem and Eugene and Medford on I-5. I detest it. I think if it's 65, it ought to just be 65.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gilman, I actually have a response for you. We have pre-filed a bill through the Transportation Commission to clean up our speed laws. We have a bowl of spaghetti for speed laws. We have different interpretations of the judges, different interpretations of law enforcement, and then every one of us have a different interpretation ourselves as a driver. One of the things that we want to do in that cleanup bill, we're not talking about what numbers are on the signs, what we want to do is treat each road the same, just as you described on the interstate. The interstate's the interstate's the interstate. Look at the capability of the road, the number of access points on the road, the 85th percentile travel speed, and have the ability for that number on the sign reflect what's true and accurate of what's going on the road. The only way we can do that now is if we clean up the statute, because the statute today has some limits in it that were actually born back in 1987 when we were talking about the fuel conservation issues. That's why we've got in some of the zones that are 55 from that, and also from too many exits. You don't want to be going where there's a lot of exits. You want to be careful you don't have fast closing speed.
Thank you.
And that number of a bill is also in your packet. I believe that one's heading to the Senate. That's Senate Bill 183 is the cleanup of the speed law.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd appreciate it if you'd help a freshman member on this committee learn a little bit more about transportation things. You mentioned the 85% rule. One of my neighborhood associations called me to say that... I'm into constituent service already, Mr. Chair. Is that, that's good, huh? Called me to ask about a road that they felt was unsafe. Because the speed traveled on the road was too high for the conditions. Their answer was ODOT did a survey and found that 85% of the drivers were driving 10 miles faster the speed limit or some proportion, and was proposing, therefore, raising the speed limit rather than helping to enforce slowing people down. Can you explain the 85% principle and how that works?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlee, I will in part, but there are those in the department that are much, much better at it than do it as a profession. The 85th percentile means that 85% of the vehicles on that road are going that speed or lower.
Right.
Well, and that means 15% are going at that speed or higher. It is only one of the items that goes into a traffic study when looking at a road and trying to determine what the appropriate posting of the number of the sign should be. Other things that come into play are the other mixes of traffic: trucks, bicycles, walkers, pedestrians, also cross driveways or side streets, also sight distance, how far people can see. And there is a speed review panel that's described in statute and in rule that when there are requests, such as the local community asked for a study to be done and the study comes forward and there is disagreement, that then goes before the speed review panel and they will have those conversations. And the speed review panel is made up of the E's that we talked about earlier. There's an engineer there, there's an enforcement there, there's a medical services person there, and they look at it and say, does it make sense to change this or not? Most of the time when there's a request for a speed study, it's actually for things to go down, as you mentioned, than it is to go up. There's a science to it. There's a process to it. And we could just take back, if you want to know a little bit more about 85th and speed setting, we can ask for that piece to be shared with you. Not my area of expertise, other than just a little bit of layman's knowledge of how it works.
Mr. Chair, if I may just follow up. Just to tell your colleagues, I don't want you to get the impression that I don't love ODOT, because I actually do. I do want to follow up and commend you all on your response to the situation in Linton, which is also in my district. It was quite amazing, both your local director and other folks in response to what was clearly a safety issue. And the community is very much appreciative of how you responded, and they're getting happier and happier with the situation that now exists in those streets. It's just too bad that it took the death of a child to make it happen, but the response was instantaneous and overwhelming.
Thank you. Thank you. If we continue, if we were to try and drive that percentage speed related from 43 to 30%, that means 80 lives each year that we would see a reduction on Oregon's roads and streets. As I mentioned earlier, the teen driving law, this was a bill actually sponsored by the 1999 House Transportation Committee Chairman, Mr. Bob Montgomery, and came from and through this committee. The teen driving law did two things. It changed the restrictions and process of a teen getting their license, and that's also the bill that moved driver education from the Department of Education to the safety office. Has it worked? Absolutely. In 1998, there were 1,200 16-year-olds behind the wheel when someone was killed or injured. That's the full year prior to the discussion here in this building and the talk about the law change. So that is a year we can use as our benchmark year to say what was happening. In 2000, the year after the law was passed, that dropped to 898 16-year-olds behind the wheel when someone was killed or injured. And in 2001, it dropped again down to 810. That's a 32% decrease in 3 years. For states that have adopted provisional licenses or graduated licensing of teens, they normally only see a 12 to 15% reduction. We saw 32%. One of the questions I get on this, well, that just means 16-year-olds aren't getting their licenses. There's not as many of them on the road. Well, that's true, but only by about 6%. So there are teens, that 16-year-olds, that are choosing to wait till they're 17, and some of them even waiting till they're 18 to get their license, because they don't want to deal with the restrictions or deal with the process of what they've got to go through in order to get their license. From a driver education front, driver education is not mandatory in Oregon. Yet there are about 16,000 sophomores that do take driver education through high schools, community colleges, educational service districts, or through private vendors that have a program that we have certified. There are 30,000 that are not. And we're setting up and doing some studies to track those that have gone through the new curriculum and the new program versus those that have not, to see if we're making a difference with the change driver education program in the state of Oregon.
Mr. Chair, I have a quick question regarding that last slide. And just to let you know, I'm one of those 810 fatalities from last, or not fatality, almost, I should say, I'm lucky I'm not a fatality. I meant to say I'm lucky to be alive, because I was involved in a head-on collision last year with a 16-year-old and almost was a fatality, and was very fortunate because it was a very scary. My car is a fatality. Fortunately, I'm not. But I have a question about other states in requiring driver ed versus, can you tell me as far as how many other states that you know, if you have that information, require driver's ed? Because that statistic does concern me, and I understand that budget is certainly an issue, but these are habits that we often, you know, use the rest of our lives. I know I went through driver ed, and it really helped because it, fortunately, I think, instilled some safety habits that I hope are going to help me not be a fatality the rest of my life, but I am concerned about that high number and the fact that a higher percentage of young drivers are not going through an official driver ed program than are. So if you can respond to that, I appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Dingfelder, I do not know, and I don't have a book with me that tells me how many are mandated and how many are not. It is a minority across the U.S. that are mandatory, and so we can get that through the state association. And I agree with you that learning to drive and deal with the transmission system is a life skill, and it's one of those things that unfortunately we tend to think happened by osmosis or by the 6 months that they're under the permit that we go out and drive with our kids or parents drive with their kids, that all of a sudden they're going to be, you know, a safe and courteous and knowledgeable driver. And when some of the people doing the teaching don't have the best of driving records, that's why driver education a lot of times is important to have.
I just have one quick follow-up regarding the statistics of that, say, for 2001 fatality, it's 810. What percentage of our overall annual fatalities are from younger drivers? That would be helpful just to know as far as for safety and injuries, or as far as the, you know, major accidents, what percentage are actually with younger drivers?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dingfelder, as a percentage of the total, mm-hmm. that 810 for the 16-year-olds alone represents just about 2.5% of all the drivers involved in fatal and injury crashes. 2.5%, but they only represent 1% of the drivers. 16-year-olds are 1% of the driving population in the state. 2.5% of the drivers involved in fatal and injury crashes.
Okay, thank
and I
you.
Think that gets to where you're wanting to go.
Yeah.
Okay.
But there were two drivers.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. On that driver education numbers, do those remain pretty constant about that?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Beyer, they have been around this number for about the past 3 or 4 years. Part of the reason why they have not grown is there is a set of money that comes through for the Student Driver Education Fund that are passed to schools as subsidy. Schools were only getting 60 cents on the dollar. Due to a change in the 99 session about how the revenue comes in, we have now been the last 3 years able to reimburse 100% of the maximum. So we're starting to see school districts, community colleges, and educational service districts add programs. And so our hope is that we'll grow the program. We have to be careful not to too fast, because then also we'll be back to the low support again.
Thank you.
Troy, where does those funds come from? Where do they derive from?
Mr. Chairman, the Student Driver Education Fund is part of the license, driver license or renewal fee. It is qualified under the Highway Fund definition because it's used for the students that take driver education to get their driver's license. So it's tied into the licensing process due to the 1999 bill, the separate 1999 bill as well.
Mr. Chair. Troy, so you're kind of saying that there are students that would take driver ed, but it's not available in a lot of cases. Am I wrong? And why don't more private companies jump into the business?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Zonner, you are correct. It's not available all over the state, and you're also correct about private companies. There are either 14 or 15 different private companies in the state that have a driving school that are offering a full driver education program that individuals can sign up for and take that certificate to DMV. Due to the constitution or the statutory limitation on the subsidy fund, the private companies don't get that. I'm anticipating a discussion in 2005 when we've got all of our, because we just took it over 2 years ago, when we get everything in place and everybody's equal, I'd like the legislature to entertain the question about should we be subsidizing the private funds for the parents that are choosing there because the high school doesn't offer it. But we're not quite there yet.
Could the private sector make it without that subsidy or not? Or what's their...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnard, they do.
That?
They do today.
Okay. So we got to figure out some way to get more of those. We have to have those kids go through that school. Your statistics prove that. So we have to figure out how the heck to make that more available without costing the taxpayers any more money.
Correct.
I had to add that.
All right. Another bill sponsored through, actually 2001, House Transportation Committee, was the booster bill for 4- and 5-year-olds. It was a part of our children and our population state that we had child safety seats up to age 4, and then, boom, put them in a safety belt, an adult-sized safety belt. The idea of the booster seat was to raise them so that they were protected. We did a tremendous amount of outreach this last year. We had, with clinics, hospitals, fire departments, a lot of our partners, we put information in their hands, Spanish and Russian. 7,500 foster care parents received direct training on this. Unfortunately, sometimes they're left out of the conversation. Because we know who they are, we were able to work through the correct channels and get the training in their hands so they could know how to deal with the different ages and sizes of kids that they see as foster parents. We have 130 law enforcement officers around the state that are master trainers that know all the ins and outs about how to deal with child seats and booster seats. They're not easy. I went to training myself. I have a 5-year-old little girl. I went to figure out to make sure that I was doing the booster seat correctly myself. And Ford Motor Company, through their program Boost America, gave to the state, and we distributed through health departments, 2,500 free booster seats, which is, in a lot of cases, was timed real well 2 years ago in order to try and get these across the state in order to be able to have our kids safer. The Work Zone Safety Program, the Safety Corridor Program, those are things that are in the safety office. This last year, we started a new program. We have Give Them a Break, and we also have Slow Down. Either my mommy or my daddy works here. We've had great success in this state. On the right-hand side, you'll notice that the numbers are going down. In the United States, the number of work zone-related fatalities has increased 33% in the last 3 years. Our numbers are going the other way. We have people that are coming in asking how we're doing it, what our partnerships are, traffic plans, coming in and evaluating, because we're a success story across the U.S. when it comes to work zone. One thing to note, it's not the worker in majority of the time that's being killed. It's the people in the car that are doing something, not recognizing they're in a zone and doing something, getting themselves in trouble and being killed or injured. Unfortunately, workers are too, but the last few years, it's been the people in the cars. What are the three biggest program priorities? And to put it in our slang, belts, booze, and speed. Between safety belts, alcohol, and speed, those things are the biggest issues and the biggest priorities. And one thing that we just did this last year was try to figure out how do those things relate in order to give us an idea of what are the biggest issues. When we look at the last 3 years, these are the number of people killed in those situations represented by each of those circles. There were 31 that were killed when the only error was not wearing a belt. There were 48 where the only error was they had alcohol in their system. 84 where the only error was speed. They were wearing their belts, but they were still killed. And this is an annual average for the last 3 years. 30 where it's speed and no belts. 35 where it's alcohol and no belts. 46 where it's speed and alcohol. And 41 where all three errors have come into play. And the important thing to point out on that chart is that upper number 84, it's the biggest one on there. People are doing everything right. They don't have alcohol in their system, and they are wearing their belt, but they're still dying. And that's they're leaving the road, hitting trees, guardrails, rolling over, crossing the center line, hitting somebody else. And unfortunately, we've seen some cases where the speed was so fast that the entire seat comes free from the car, because there's so much energy in that particular crash. So how does Oregon rate? Well, for the past 10 years or so, Oregon was in the lower third when it came to highway safety. We were worse than the average on rates. We didn't have a high safety belt use rate. We had a higher teen driving rate. We did all these different things. We had a higher than average alcohol rate. But for the past 4 years, Oregon's record has turned around, and we are now one of the top states in the United States. In fact, Mr. Bob Ullman is here from, as part of USDOT researcher, investigating how we deal with some of our alcohol data, and was here yesterday and today to do some research. We have people coming in from out of state to talk to us. State of Georgia highway safety officials came in for 3 or 4 days to investigate what was going on, and want to try and duplicate some of the things that we've done the past few years. And to highlight that, as Director Warner said, 2002 was a very low year, and 1999 was the other very low year. And in 1999, we dropped from the prior year 124 fatalities, 1 year to the next. 23% decline. That was the largest decline in the entire United States in 1999. Our decline last year of 60 fewer fatalities from 2001 to 2002 is the largest decline of the western 14 states. I can't say anything about the rest because I haven't gotten the numbers from them yet, but we've had the best drop of the western side of the U.S. We've seen that we've had vehicle deaths, people in the cars, the lowest since 1955. Our bicyclist deaths are the lowest in 20 years. Motorcyclist deaths, lowest since 1963. Pedestrian deaths, the lowest since 1944. And that number, 2002 as well, was the lowest pedestrian. It tied 1999 and was the lowest since 1944. Motor carrier-related deaths are down 25%. And hopefully when Greg DelPonte talks to you about motor carrier programs, you'll see why and the great programs that they run. And the only way it gets done is by those three E's. Any one of those on their own will put a lot of energy out there and unfortunately tread water. We need the other pieces and the other parts in there to make a difference. When you look at our population and the amount of roads we have, the cars we've had, and what's happened over time, the darker line is Oregon and the lighter line is the United States. In the 1950 to 1957, you'll see Oregon was better than the national average. But from 1957 all the way until 1997, we were at or worse than the national average. And it's been this last 4 years where we have done a lot of good work and made a big difference and are significantly below the national average, 20% better than the national average in this state for 4 years running. And unfortunately, this is somewhat, for me, it's a little bit of a gruesome chart because this is actually the number of people that die on Oregon's roads every year for the past 50 years. It's 25,000 people on that table right there. On that chart, call the highlight box for you though is to call out the fact that we have been making a difference. The last 4 years have been below 500 fatalities. The last time we had four consecutive years below 500 fatalities was 1959 to 1962, and it's by having all the partners together, legislature right in there with the best of them, in order to try and make a difference, in order to get these numbers to go down. And deaths aren't the only story. We look at the injuries as well. The lower line tells you how many people are injured in traffic crashes in the state. And from 1996 to 2001, we've had a 30% reduction in the number of people who are injured in traffic crashes. But still, 27,000 people were injured. That's every person in the city of Albany going to the hospital in 1 year. It's 27,000 people injured in traffic crashes. The economic cost of traffic crashes: every fatality we reduce has a $1 million economic impact. For every injury we can reduce is a $50,000 economic impact. No hospital charges, no treatment charges, no training of a new employee, and medical charges. What does the future hold? Well, the nature of impaired driving is different. And a part of that is those other drugs that drivers are deciding to use and self-medicate. Using over-the-counter drugs or prescription drugs more and abusing them or combining them and not letting their doctors know that they're doing that. We have, as Rosa Mabry talked about, reduction potentially in law enforcement. It's not just state police. I've heard of two or three counties that have been letting go deputies as well. Their presence is going to have an impact on our roads. We have to be careful we don't rest on our success and just basically step back and let things stay as they are. We need to keep pushing in order to keep making a difference. And we have to be careful that the laws that we have in place are there for a reason, and our office is trying everywhere we can to make sure we have solid research behind it to show you and citizens and other public bodies what difference the laws make. And if they don't make a difference, then they shouldn't be there. But for laws that are making a difference, we want to make sure we keep them there so that we keep having the success that we've had in highway safety. Some of the specific needs, and these tie to some of the legislative concepts that are in your packet, and one of those, as we discussed earlier, was a broader definition of DUI so those offenders can get involved in evaluation or treatment. We need to focus on our youth. We have some of our youth in certain situations are not protected. We have situations where teen drivers under the age of 21 have alcohol in their system, but they don't make it into the courts to a DUI. It gets bargained down to a minor in possession of alcohol. And those are two very different types of crimes and offenses, driving under the influence and minor in possession. Our hope is we can have some discussion to try and fill that gap. And it's actually House Bill 2264, which is to have that conversation. Is there something in the middle that we need to deal with these youth that are deciding to drink and then drive and know better? We need to continue working on roadway improvements. We're trying to help cities and counties see some of the things that ODOT has done on the highway system so that they can do some road improvements themselves, because quite often some of the minor injury and unfortunately the rural county roads, there are some roads that we need to look at improving, and we can do some spot things to make them better. Our statutes, he's talked about speed being a bowl of spaghetti, so is our equipment statute. There's a lot of things that Oregon is supposed to be doing for equipment that actually NHTSA, through their crash testing, does. We need to get out of being in the middle, because we're putting a burden on ourselves that someone else is already doing, and we need to take advantage of the federal rules and the federal programs and not have us do it. And then finally, we need to watch what goes on in Congress. We want to encourage Congress to do incentive programs. Oregon has been one of six states this last 5 years that have received every incentive program Congress has out there for highway safety. Because we've had .08, we've got .08 for our blood alcohol law, we've gotten money. Because we've been a high safety belt use rate state, we've gotten money. They're looking at changing that to sanctions. If you don't have .08, we're going to take money. If you don't have safety belt law, we're going to take money. Well, Oregon could check the box, but we're not going to have money to program in highway safety to do some of these great things that we're trying to do in implementing new laws and saving lives and reducing injuries. Overall, safety is only accomplished if we all work together from our own points of view, personally as well as professionally. And the past 4 years have been a string of success that we've never seen in this state since the Highway Safety Office was created in 1967. 430 people did die last year, and we need to take a second to pause and actually smile and say, good job. We've done a great job of reducing the death toll and the injury toll in the state, but that still means 430 people didn't get home. They weren't there for the holidays, and they aren't coming back. And we need to make sure that we have an impact, because still more than one person every day is dying on these roads and streets in the state. I want to thank you for your leadership, for your interest, for your trust. We have done a great job in saving lives, reducing injuries, and I'm looking forward to continuing that in the future. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Troy. Can you tell me, do you have any information on driving safety and the use of cell phones?
Is it my question?
Do you track that in any way?
Mr. Chairman, the state crash database started tracking cell phone use in 1997. It's only captured in the database if the driver admits to it when they fill out their report, or the officer writes it in their report and confirms it. Because you get a lot of, I said, she said type of a situation. It is tracked. It is very, very small. It's less than 1%. There have been some fatal crashes recently with drivers on cell phones, but it's only two or three. It is not, it doesn't come in as a priority issue, at least as far as the crash statistics that we are capturing.
Thank you. Representative Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was one that I was hoping, I have a constituent who has a real interest in this, and I was hoping maybe that at some point we could talk about it. I didn't know whether this group wanted to hear all about it, but the other thing I wanted to know was, is any of this, the statistics that you have here, is any of that available on the web?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Byer, every year we put together our performance plan, and this is in Word format and PDF format on the web through the Safety Division website, as is our DUI book, which we'll actually get you copies of. And they can access that. Every one of our program areas, some of the ones you just saw, we have a specific set of pages and data on every one of those things. We didn't have a website until about 2 years ago, and once we put it in there, it gets lit up a lot for requests. One thing I did fail to mention, Mr. Chairman, in part of the budget, every year we put together our performance plan with our goals and our expectations of our performance. Every dollar, including the money that pays for staff. And this goes through the Transportation Commission, the Safety Committee, the DUI Committee, and a lot of other citizen groups that explains where every one of our dollars are going to. And so in a biennium, if I had two of them, I could hold it up and say, here's the biennium budget. that we have for our plan. So it's all outlined in what our goals and expectations are.
Mr. Chair, just a moment ago you made a statistic about the fact that as we improved, the feds weren't giving us any more money. Is that the way I read that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Zahner, it is one of the potential options for the next reauthorization in how Congress handles highway safety is to put in sanctions on states versus incentive on states. We've got to wait to see what Congress does for 2004-2009.
Sanction? You mean if you're doing good, they're sanctioning? I'm not quite understanding that.
Mr. Chairman,
they're sanctioning.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Zahner, for instance, this past 5 years we've received money because we've had 0.08 blood alcohol law as our standard.
Okay.
Starting this year, if you are a state that does not have 0.08, 3% of your construction funds for highway is taken away from that state.
Oh, okay.
And held in an account until you pass 0.08, and then they give it back to you.
Representative Greenwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair.
Through you and Ding Felder, I figured that.
One of the issues that I'm sure will be back with us this year is mandatory motorcycle helmet laws. That is in your bailiwick, I think, and
yes.
I didn't mention it. 4 years ago, I chaired a consensus conference with the ABATE, the motorcycle lobby, and the CDC to create a document about what was known and what was not known about the impact of mandatory motorcycle laws. I saw an abstract of recently a study of a state, I think Connecticut, but I'm not sure, some state that put mandatory motorcycle helmet laws in and did a very careful tracking of it. I wonder if you, when the time comes, if you'll be briefing us and with I assume the STAR, formerly known as the State Health Division, whatever they are now, as well on that issue, because I've been told by the motorcycle lobby folks, friends, that it will be back with us again.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Greenlee, yes, you are correct, and when the debates have come up, we have been here. Oregon has had times where we've had a helmet law and no helmet law and then back again, and the numbers are very startling to see. When we had no helmet law, they are 25 to 30 fatalities per year higher than when the years we had the law.
I'm familiar with that, but I wonder if there's something that you have since you have access to the state study since, say, 2001.
Mr. Chairman, if you could
track that
check
for us, it would be very helpful. When the time comes, I'm sure we're going to get it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Troy, for a very good presentation. We'll be looking forward to seeing you later in the session.
Thanks, sir. I appreciate the time.
Thank you again. Committee, Janet, could you sort of outline a little bit what we're going to be dealing with next week?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Monday will be a regular committee meeting day at 8:30, even though it's Martin Luther King Day. There will be a legislative session, and we'll have a committee meeting Monday. And we're having two more division overviews, rail and DMV, and Monday we'll also have a bill, a Lincoln County's bill that fixes a glitch in a funding source that they've been receiving but were not technically eligible to receive. And so that will be our first bill on Monday. And Wednesday, two more divisional overviews, and then Friday we meet at 8 o'clock on the front steps, and you'll be getting a letter so your offices know also to go out to the maintenance, ODOT's region maintenance facility on State Street. It's not very far from here, and that's a real good tour. People that have done it in the past really come away with a lot more appreciation and understanding of what the maintenance crews do, and that they see their equipment and et cetera. So that's it for next week, and we may have some bills on the agenda for Wednesday as well. We just don't have enough to really pick through yet to do some pretty straightforward ones. So,
it's our intention that we'll work some of the more easier bills to start with and to get our feet on the ground.
Training wheels bills.
Yeah,
huh?
Training wheels.
Mr. Chairman, I think I understood Wednesday we would take a tour and be back in time for a session, but Friday we would be excused, or is that the following week?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. We will be here Wednesday, regular meeting next Wednesday. It's
okay.
Friday the 24th when we'll be going out on a tour, and you will be back for floor session that Friday on the 24th. We've asked you to be excused from floor session the following Friday, the 31st, because we'll be going up to Woodburn, the port of entry, and having a motor carrier overview that day. So Monday and Wednesday are regular meetings here in this room at 8:30, and the following two Fridays are 8 o'clock to go on a tour.
And do we dress any differently? I mean, do we need warm clothes or boots or...
Put on your coveralls, John. You're going to have to work.
Drive a grader.
You can. You may even get to go under a truck. No.
How fun.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, I would wear comfortable shoes and on the. But I don't. And you may just want to have a sweater or jacket on. But we won't be outside very much.
I think that Friday that we go to the weigh station up here on I-5, Representative Greenleaf and Dinkfelder could possibly meet at the place of coming clear here to Salem, meet us up there.
Well, and also Janet promised me I could take time off and stop at the discount stores.
Right.
Blue store again.
Or maybe she didn't. Maybe she said no. I don't remember which it was.
Is there any other comments or questions by the committee? Hearing none, we are now adjourned.